Welcome everyone to today's conference. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Tim Pagliari. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining me today for the Investors Unite pre-inaugural teleconference. This is our first teleconference of the year, and as everyone is aware, this year will be one of big changes in Washington. As GSE shareholders, we are all eager to learn how these changes might affect us. There have been many pathways suggested for the GSEs, and of course, there remain several pending legal cases brought by GSE shareholders. No matter what happens, however, one thing is clear: GSE shareholders must be treated in accordance with the rule of law moving forward. On today's call, we have Professor Sai Prakash of the University of Virginia School of Law, Professor John Yu of the University of California Berkeley School of Law, and Horace Cooper, Senior Fellow at the National Center for Public Policy Research. I will now turn the call over to Professor Prakash. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim, and good morning to all the folks listening. It's safe to say that things were on autopilot during the last several months of the Obama administration. They were just sort of waiting out the clock, trying to keep the cases, the controversy, and documents under wraps, especially the latter. But now that a new administration is coming to office, there's a chance for reevaluation and reconsideration and a chance to turn the page on the net worth sweep. Just after his selection was announced in November, Treasury Secretary-designate Steve Mnuchin told Fox Business News that getting Fannie and Freddie out of the government control would be a top 10 priority for the Trump administration. And he thought it would be relatively easy to do and be done relatively quickly. He said it made no sense for the government to own these two enterprises and that privatization was in order. He'll likely be asked about this tomorrow before the Senate Finance Committee, and what he says will be key. I don't know if he's got a fully developed plan for achieving what he's laid out, but obviously, if there's going to be a change in the government's approach, it might have implications for these cases. I suspect that the judges that are hearing these cases, at least some of them, will want to give the new administration some time to determine what their stance on these cases are, to determine whether they're going to continue fighting in these cases. And, of course, the administration will need time, if they're given time by the judges, to try to figure out what they're going to do. I hope that the administration ends the sweep, reverts the sweep, and protects shareholders, of course, and then, of course, protects taxpayers. With respect to the claims of executive privilege and the protective order, the government has a number of options. Remember, the government turned over some documents in the Fair Home Funds case and asked that they be placed under protective order, meaning that people like you and me could not see them, only the lawyers could. With respect to thousands of other documents, the government claimed executive privilege and tried to shield them, even from the attorneys involved in the case, despite the fact that the plaintiffs have a right to discovery. Now, Judge Sweeney, Margaret Sweeney of the Court of Claims, has been slowly chipping away at those claims. She's actually unsealed several documents that have been useful to plaintiffs in other cases, and so she's partially lifted the protective order. And then more recently, she found that she sampled some 57 documents that the government had asserted executive privilege over, or various sorts of privilege, and she determined that the privileges did not apply to any one of those documents. And that ruling was a rather sweeping rebuke of the government's position, and I think it presaged the wholesale rejection of all the government's claims of executive privilege in the Fair Home Funds case. And, you know, given what Judge Sweeney said, I just don't know how the government could continue to not hand over those documents to the plaintiffs. So what will the government do now? It's quite possible that the government will say, look, we've got this order from Judge Sweeney about executive privilege and other sorts of privileges, and we've lost on every single one of these documents. Perhaps we just need to turn over these documents now. With respect to the protective order, maybe they'll finally decide to ask the judge to lift that protective order because the effect on the market that the government alleged is, you know, it's been like 4 years or so since those deliberations were made in the government. There's really no reason to continue to have a protective order that prevents the public from knowing what's going on. More generally, these cases are, I think, in part going to turn on what the government does with the net worth sweep. If they decide to end that sweep, and privatize Fannie and Freddie, then, you know, these cases are just sort of smaller parts of a bigger puzzle. So that's what I see happening going forward, Tim.
Terrific. Well, thank you, Cy. I will now turn the call over to Professor Yu.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks, Tim, for inviting me to participate. And I'd like to say also hi to Horace and Cy, both people I've known over a long period of time working in constitutional law. I think that this claim of executive privilege is one that could easily be reversed by a President Trump and the incoming administration. One thing that I've worked on is the power of the presidency, and particularly the power of the president to reverse the previous decisions of other presidents, especially here, because here the claims, I think, are simply on weak sand or unjustified as a matter of the real application of executive privilege as it's been applied by past presidents. But first, even just to start, even if there were a real claim, a legitimate use of constitutional power here, no president can bind any future president in the exercise of their constitutional duties. So even if the Obama administration had a legitimate claim of executive privilege here, President Trump is not bound by that claim, and he is always free, he and his attorney general are always free to waive the privilege and to, and then, as Cy suggested, to release the documents or settle the case or do whatever it wishes. The Obama administration's claim of executive privilege cannot bind any future president. But I think even this is a particularly good case to do that, because here the claim of executive privilege just doesn't fall within any generally accepted understanding of the president's right to keep certain kinds of documents and communications secret. The foundational case for this still remains the Watergate tapes case, United States versus Nixon. And in that case, the court said there is a constitutional root for executive privilege, but that the reason it exists is so that the president himself or herself can receive candid communications and advice in the areas of his or her constitutional responsibilities. So the court said those areas in particular are national security, defense, diplomatic, and then in later cases it's also said law enforcement. But the most important thing, aside from those areas, is that those communications have to be with the president. They aren't, that the executive privilege, the court never said, extends to, for example, discussions between officials and the agencies or sub-cabinet officials. So here, there are two grounds on which the claim to executive privilege just doesn't fly and is not justified under any understanding of past judicial precedent about executive privilege. You know, one, this is not communications with the president. There's no claim here that President Obama is involved with any of these discussions or communications or documents. But even more importantly, second, the subject matter of the claim of executive privilege here, you know, falls outside those areas that the Supreme Court has identified as core to the right of the president to receive confidential communications. Here you've got discussions about financial information. And even though the amount of money is large, and even though the claim might be that the subject matter at the time during the financial crisis and its aftermath was extremely important for the health of the economy, there's no constitutional right to keep discussion of financial matters secret. The Constitution's grant of executive authority to the president just doesn't include some kind of free-floating constitutional power over the country's financial markets. And so I think, you know, Cy pointed out that there's important ways that the United States government can choose to settle the case. I also think that the election here makes a big difference. As you said, you know, this is your pre-inaugural Investors United conference call. I think the presidential election makes a big difference here because it always gives an incoming president the opportunity to review the constitutional claims of the last president to decide whether to change or alter them. And this provides a really good opportunity, I think, for the Trump administration to make a stand in favor of greater transparency and accountability and pull away from the Obama administration's, I think, excessive claims of secrecy. Thank you.
Well, terrific. Thank you, John. Horace, welcome. I believe this is the first time we've had the privilege of having you on an Investors Unite conference call, so take it away.
Thank you. Good morning, and I appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk with you guys about this issue. I think that there are a lot of very, very important concerns as to how the election and the new Congress and the administration are going to address this, which I know that our earlier guests have already talked much about the substance of this issue. I wanted to just give a little bit of a sense of the impression that people can perceive with regard to how the Congress and the new administration are going to work together. One of the issues I think that hasn't been given a lot of attention is the way that the sweeps and the executive privilege have combined to impact other policy discussions. For instance, with the debt limit, there were communications between the Treasury Department and the Capitol Hill arguing that there had been some manipulation of this process to count the reserves associated with the sweep as a means of allowing for extended borrowing on the part of the administration. Now, on the one hand, you can't actually keep private, or you shouldn't be allowed to keep private, what the specific nature of the communications and actions were with regard to the sweeps, and on the other hand, use your internal record keeping of what it is that you claim that you're able to track as a way of limiting the need for the administration to sit down with the Congress to determine what the debt ceiling appropriately ought to be. There are significant concerns that still remain on the part of the new Congress coming in 2017 that are not going to allow that issue to just simply go away. In late, I guess it was October, the fall of 2016, Senator Shelby requested that there be a formal investigation of how the Fannie Mae and the other financial services entities that were initially so-called independent ones are operating, and there is a likelihood that we're going to see a decision by the Congress to say that if GAO and CBO are going to do these investigations, that they also look into what are the nature of executive privilege, how has it played a role in their responsibilities, and ask that those communications likely be examined and determine whether or not those were appropriate. The new Judiciary Committee on the Senate side is likely with Senator Lee and Senator Cruz to have opportunities to have a higher platform as skeptics of the means by which the administration has operated, in particular its use of executive privilege, and now will be able to ask without having to have a separation of powers fight over information. As John, you indicated, it is likely now with this change in place and no institutional need to maintain the hide behind the cloth of what decisions had been made, that there's likely to be a great degree of transparency. And it would become incumbent, I would say, on the part of the new administration, rather than continue forward to keep in place this shield that instead of owning all of that, that there would be a lot more willingness to share details and ultimately likely to reverse the policy generally. Even if, I would predict, even if a formal decision wasn't made, the release of information would reveal so much about how this process came about. So what we're looking at, as I say, is there are residual effects broadly that the new incoming Congress and in a relationship with the new administration are likely to see a more collaborative opportunity to operate rather than the more combative one that had existed. And so in my view, I think this gives this entire area opportunity for new analysis, new approach, and probably most likely a reversal. So those are my comments.
Well, terrific. Thank you, Horace. So, operator, will you now give us some instructions on how we'll be able to take a few calls for our panelists? And then after you do that, I'll ask the first question while you're getting calls in the queue.
Certainly. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone telephone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone.
Great. Well, this is for any one of the three of you. With the new administration, first of all, what kind of time frame do you think it would take for the Attorney General to advise the President on the release of documents that have been, you know, the subject of executive privilege? And secondly, what would the impact be of just a reversal by the D.C. Circuit that invalidated the net worth sweep as a matter of law?
Well, why don't I, this is John Yu, why don't I take the first question, and then I think Cy could take the second question. I'll take the first question just because I used to handle exactly those matters when I was in the Bush administration. And there's an internal process within the Justice Department for analyzing executive privilege claims. It goes to an office, the one that I used to work in, called the Office of Legal Counsel, which makes a recommendation to the Attorney General, and then the Attorney General makes a recommendation to the President. Usually that process takes quite some time. It can take months, but this is different because this would be not the claim of executive privilege, which takes a fair amount of research into past precedents and practice, but this would just be the decision not to invoke it. There are plenty of times when the president or the executive branch could claim executive privilege and chooses not to because the subject matter isn't important enough or there are other reasons involving a desire for greater transparency. And so this, I think, would be one of those cases. And so actually those kinds of issues can be decided much more quickly than to invoke executive privilege. It could, I mean, I don't see any reason why it couldn't be done within a month of President Trump's taking office.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree with Tim. This is Cy. I agree with what John just said, and I'd add that, you know, I think if you're the administration and you want to see the GSEs privatized, it might be quite useful to have all those documents made public, because I think those documents will perhaps show that that, you know, the government knew that the GSEs were about to turn the corner and make lots of profits, right? And so the claim that they were doing the net worth sweep because they weren't going to make any, the GSEs weren't going to make any profits and had no prospect of paying the dividend, I think that claim has been exploded and is likely to be exploded further by release of these documents. And so you might make it easier to privatize them and to stop the net worth sweep if you expose the deliberations that led to that decision, the deliberations that might suggest other motives for the net worth sweep. On your second question having to do with the D.C. Circuit, I think that also would be useful for the administration, right? If the D.C. Circuit says the net worth sweep is illegal, the government does not have to appeal that to the Supreme Court. It does not have to seek en banc review. if it wants to privatize them anyway, that wouldn't be a bad thing at all. It actually, you know, it would be more embarrassing if the D.C. Circuit upheld the net worth sweep, right? Because then the government would have to say, the Trump administration would have to say, well, the D.C. Circuit upheld it, but we still think it's problematic. And so in a way, you know, it'd be better for people who think the net worth sweep is, if the D.C. Circuit's going to come out and say the net worth sweep was legal or not reach the merits, it might be better for them to stay their hand and give the administration time to formulate a policy.
Terrific. Operator, I think we're ready for our first question, if you have one in the queue. Hello?
Yes, we will take our first question from Stephanie Duhey with CNBC. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Actually do. My question is about deadlines. I mean, this has been going on for so long and seemingly without any kind of deadline. What should we be looking for in terms of action points? When might we see things happen either in the court or in the Congress? It sounds like you think the court is going to happen first.
Anybody can answer that. I think that the U.S. court, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals case was heard in oral argument back in April, and so that decision could come down any time. They release on Tuesday and Friday, and I think you could get a decision on the U.S. Court of Claims appeal at any time. Deadline on Congress, I mean, Horace, what's your take on that?
Well, I think it's more a case of when will things metastasize. As I was mentioning in my opening statement, during the conflict over the debt ceiling, a similar series of arguments were made about what internal accounting was occurring that was kept from the Congress. And even as late as last year, the Congress was still requesting this information, and I am under the impression that Jeff Hensarling is going to maintain that request to get that information. As the incoming administration's leadership team comes in, those pending requests are going to be sitting on their table, and those will likely get answered certainly before the summer, could be as early as the spring. I would imagine that the internal discussion about how to respond to that is likely to influence the decisions of whether or not they're going to reverse generally. This is not the exact same issue, but it is the exact same protocol where the internal conversations within the agency were made that seemed contrary to what the public information has been with regard to the decision making, dramatically keeping in a way that the law, I think, had never contemplated this information from being made public. The Congress of the United States doesn't just simply say, oh, well, we've got a new president, we're now done with this issue. They're very, very likely to continue pressing it. So as I would answer, we are likely to see something certainly by the spring and no later than the summer with regard to responsiveness on how executive privilege was abused in this case.
And let me just put a different slant on that, or, you know, in the way I've looked at it. The issue is, if the sweep was illegal, and if it was contrived to create an additional source of revenue to offset the impact of the Budget Control Act and the sequester, and then was Congress, were they fully aware of what was happening and the impact of that? I think that goes to the heart of all of this. And if the discussions about grabbing this money centered around getting around the sequester and the requirements of the Budget Control Act, essentially what you have is a form of internal embezzlement that potentially the administration and some of the senior people in the administration were going all the way through the Treasury could have been involved in. because
and
they
the
broke the rules.
Important, the reason that's important is it was the requirement of the Department of Treasury to formally assert that they were in compliance with the statute. And if, in fact, they knew that they were not and they kept that information, that's a significant breach. And this is this problem of attempting to use executive privilege in this particular way, not for the purpose of actually ensuring energetic communications can occur or protecting national security, but in fact to avoid the political consequences of the decisions that are being made by the administration. That's not the purpose of executive privilege.
And the, you know, just one final note on it, just to remind everybody, this was all very material from a financial standpoint. The sequester, you know, and all the budget problems in 2012 and 13 were over Congress's inability to agree on $50 billion worth of cuts. Well, the first $60 billion payment from Fannie Mae went into the Treasury June 30th, 2013. And most of the money that came from writing up the deferred tax assets and some of the other reserves that were released, they flooded the Treasury in 13 and 14. And it's, you know, tailed off as they basically depleted the assets of these companies. But it's very material. And I think that is something that is going to be, you know, it will come out of those reports. It's pretty self-evident.
Tim, if I could just weigh in on Stephanie's question. This is Cy.
Yes.
Stephanie's question, I think, goes to two different things. One is the case, and one is what Congress might do.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what you said, Tim, and I think this is absolutely right, the government can stop the network sweep tomorrow without going to Congress and without regard to what the court says. The government can decide, hey, we've looked at the statute, we've looked at the conservatorship, and this is inconsistent with it, and we're no longer going to continue this policy. And they don't need to go to Congress to do that. They need to go to Congress if they want to, you know, pass new legislation with respect to Fannie and Freddie, but they don't need to go to Congress to stop the network sweep.
Great. Operator, next question.
Yes, we will go next to Gelman with Aaron Associates. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yes, I was wondering about use of the term privatization. But Fannie and Freddie are, while GSC supported, are private companies. So the notion of privatization is a bit confusing to me, and or sort of suggests that the shareholders of Fannie and Freddie may lose out so as to reprivatize under a different capitalization, ignoring the first capital structure.
I'm not sure if that's directed to me, but I think I was just quoting the Treasury designate. I think what all that he's referring to is to taking the companies out of the conservatorship. I don't think he's referring to wiping out the shareholders and getting new shareholders. And I don't think it's been understood to do that. So I think perhaps you misunderstood what I was trying to convey.
And I think the other thing to remember is that there's still a process under HERA. I mean, these entities are in conservatorship. It hasn't changed the legal rights of the shareholders or the preferred shareholders. And to wipe out the preferred shareholders or the existing shareholders would take some type of receivership or liquidation or reorganization, and that hasn't, you know, their rights still exist. And the new Treasury Secretary designee, I think, is very much aware of that. I think we've got time for one more question. Is there one there for us, operator?
Yes. We will go to Ed Keeley with Borgen Investment. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. I have a two-part question, somewhat related. I was under the impression, the first part is, I was under the impression that the writ of mandamus is typically decided relatively quickly by the appeals court. And that's the first part of the question. What is that timeline? And then relatedly, is it possible that the D.C. Circuit is choosing to wait for that writ of mandamus ruling to make their ruling, because that could influence further document production that's been withheld because of executive privilege? That's my question. Thank you.
Professor Yu, you want to take that?
So as I understand, I understand the question. It's about the whether the court can use the writ of mandamus to order the production of this information from the court. I just wanted to make sure I've got the question right.
My understanding was that government appealed and to suggest that Judge Sweeney has made an error on her ruling, and that the ten appeals court judges have to rule on that or agree on that writ of mandamus to overturn her decision, and that is supposed to come, I thought, in a relatively that decision was supposed to be handed down in a relatively short period of time, maybe as little as 30 days.
Oh, I see. You mean at the court, or not at the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals?
Correct.
But at her court, the court of claims.
Correct.
So,
therein would the D.C. Circuit want to see what the Court of Claims decision was on the writ of mandamus before they released their opinion in the Perry case?
Oh, that's an interesting question. You know, I would think, I'd have to go and look, and Sai might have an idea about this too, about this idea of the court, all the judges on a court getting together to use the power writ of mandamus to reverse one of the individual judges. It is possible. It doesn't happen a lot. You know, most of the time, this is what is usually called an en banc procedure. Particularly when it comes to a trial-level court like the Court of Claims or a federal district court, it's pretty rare for that to happen. So even though procedurally it's possible, the judges don't use that power a whole lot. It's pretty unusual when they do. Usually they're more than happy to allow allow the case where they're that divided to just go up to the appeals court, which in this case would not be the D.C. Circuit. I believe it would be the Court of the Federal Circuit. This is the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. But I do agree that with that second point you made, that if you're the D.C. Circuit, you have a fair amount of flexibility as to when you issue your decision, and you don't want to exercise judicial power more so when you vote against the government, if there might be changes of the facts on the ground that make your decision less relevant or change the assumptions you had when you made the decision. So I agree with you on the second point, that I could easily see the D.C. Circuit holding its decision, especially if the judges are still drafting opinions or arguing about the issues, to wait to see what might happen with the Court of Claims, or even to see if the new administration might want to reverse its position on the issue. That's a good point you make.
Great question. Well, to all of our panelists, Professor Yu, Horace Cooper, and Professor Prakash, thank you for your time this morning, and all the members and media that was present on the call. We look forward to a big year and a year of change as GSE shareholders, and we will keep you informed. So everybody have a great day. Thank you again.